Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, and we're delighted to have you here at the New York Public Library for this evening's program, which I'm sure will be terrific. Before I introduce tonight's speakers, I'd like to thank the co-sponsor of the event, the Museum of American Finance, and we are all extremely grateful to Betsy Bradley, the Deputy Director of the Cullman Center, for her excellent work in organizing this program and bringing all the elements together to make it work. Thank you, Betsy. We have two remaining events in the Cullman Center's Conversation from the Cullman Center, that was redundant, this spring. The first is a musical theater piece by graphic novelist and former Cullman Center fellow Ben Ketcher and the composer Mark Mulcahy called A Check Room Romance. That event is actually sold out, so I shouldn't really be announcing it, but it's got two performances, and there might be tickets at the door. They're really fabulous performances, so if you feel like taking a chance, you should come to the door on the 13th and the 15th and try. On May 27th, another former Cullman Center fellow, the novelist Danzy Senna, will be talking about her beautifully written, gripping new nonfiction book about growing up in an interracial family called Where Did You Sleep Last Night? She'll be talking with the writer, Rebecca Walker. You'll find flyers with information about this program, actually both programs, on the table by the exit, or where you just came in, by the entrance, and also a sign-up sheet in case you're not already on our email list and would like to know about our upcoming programs for next year, for instance. Tonight's conversation, as you know, since you're here, will be about T.J. Styles' superb new book, about Cornelius Vanderbilt, the first tycoon. Speaking of superb, the reviews of this book have been fabulous. Perhaps some of you saw the one in yesterday's New York Times. It called the book a mighty and mighty confident work, one that moves with force and conviction and imperious wit through Vanderbilt's noisy life and times. This is state-of-the-art biography. The review referred to the book a couple of times as The Last Tycoon, which no doubt pleased the ghost of F. Scott Fitzgerald, but maybe not TJ's publishers. The paper ran a correction today, actually. TJ worked on this monumental book, the Times called it Whacking, while he was a fellow at the Cullman Center in 2004, 2005, and he found many treasures in the New York Public Library's manuscripts division. If you didn't stop to look at the wonderful one-night-only exhibition of some of the materials TJ found here in the case on the north side of the room right over there, you should definitely take a look before you leave. It's really interesting. There are letters to and from Vanderbilt, members of his family, Samuel Tilden, Horace Greeley, and lots of others. Special thanks to TJ and William Stingone, the library's curator of manuscripts, and to Miriam D'Artani, the exhibition's conservator, for selecting and setting up this unique small exhibition. The Boston Globe ran another eminently quotable review of the first tycoon. I have to hesitate. First, last. Styles has painted a full-bodied, nuanced picture of the man. Elegance of style, no pun intended, I'm sure. Elegance of style and fair-minded intent illuminate Styles' latest expectedly profound exploration of American culture in the raw. Expectedly profound because Styles' previous book, Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War, established him as an author from whom we can expect both first-rate writing and first-rate history, which is what we really at the Cullman Center want to promote. Which brings me to the man who will be, first-rate writing and first-rate history, brings me to the man who will be interviewing TJ tonight, the best-selling novelist Kevin Baker. Paradise Alley, the middle volume in Baker's trilogy of historical novels set in New York, won the James Fenimore Cooper Prize for Best Historical Fiction from the Society of American Historians in 2003. The final volume, Stryver's Row, set in Harlem in the 1940s, came out in 2006. Pete Hamill in the New York Times called it a brave, honorable work, taking us into a vanished world that should be better known. More important, Baker imagines his human subjects with a sense of pity and compassion and embrace, thus making them visible in ways that are fresh and new. These two writers have a great deal in common and a great deal to talk about, and I won't take up another second of their time, except to say that that they'll talk for about 45 minutes and then take questions and answers, and you will be able to buy both the first Tycoon, which I should have held up before, and Strivers Row at a table just outside these doors as you leave. Since the authors are going to need to get out there, please don't come up and throng them and ask questions here. You can ask your questions out there. Now, I won't take up another second.
Thank you. Yes, no thronging, please. thanks so much, Jean. Thanks for coming, everyone, to this evening. It's a pleasure to be here at the library and the Coleman Center, which has once again succeeded in bringing to publication an outstanding work of literature. The first Tycoon takes its place this year as the biography of record of one of the greatest and most neglected figures in American business history. Cornelius Vanderbilt's career in shipping, railroads, and finance spanned an incredible epoch in the industrial development of this nation, from the very beginnings of steam-powered transportation to the tying together of the entire North American continent in a steel web of rail. As T.J. Stiles writes, few 19th century businessmen equaled Vanderbilt in his impact on American history. And of those who did, arguably none proved to be so influential at so fundamental a level over a period so formative or so long. Born in 1794, the Commodore lived to be 82 and played a significant role in so many of the leading events in his tumultuous life. From the very beginnings of steamboat travel on the Hudson River to the seminal Supreme Court case, Gibbons v. Ogden, establishing the federal government's right to regulate interstate commerce and destroying the remnants of feudal culture in America, to transatlantic travel, the California Gold Rush, and the growth of the United States into a continental nation, the start of travel across Central America and the planting of the seed that was to become the Panama Canal, the crushing of the notorious American filibuster, William Walker, in his attempt to abscond with the country of Nicaragua, the destruction of the Confederate ironclad Merrimack, and the safeguarding of the Union's gold shipments, both of which played a seminal part in winning the Civil War, the fabled stock manipulations of the Erie Railroad and the birth of the modern corporation, the consolidation of the great New York rail lines into the enormous New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, the growth of New York City into the first city of America, and a major world hub of finance and trade, complete with its first Grand Central Station. Vanderbilt played a major part in all of these events and more. As Stiles writes, the Commodore's life left its mark on Americans' most basic beliefs about equality and opportunity. He started in business as the very epitome of the Jacksonian ideal, the working man desiring only a level playing field to compete against the vested interests. He ended it as a symbol of inequality and monopoly in the Gilded Age, one who made Americans question for the first time the dangers of gigantism in business. He was instrumental in acquainting Americans with the very idea of the modern corporation, of an enormous depersonalized business entity. When Cornelius Vanderbilt was a young man, Americans worked almost exclusively as farmers and small businessmen, and what money they saw was mostly solid coin. Corporations were a rarity. Entities of limited duration formed mostly to complete large public projects, such as roads or canals, before being disbanded. By the time Vanderbilt died, Americans had been introduced to paper money and stocks and bonds and even more abstract representations of wealth, even if they were still uneasy about it, getting more uneasy all the time. Vanderbilt's own life served as an epic within the epoch. He started out as a teenage farm boy with a few years of grade school education, sailing a homemade ferry across New York Harbor from Staten Island. By the time of his death, he was estimated to be the second richest man in America, with a fortune of roughly $100 million. To give you an idea of what that meant, Stiles writes that if Vanderbilt had somehow been able to liquidate his entire estate, he would have received one out of every $9 then in circulation. By way of comparison, if Bill Gates, worth $57 billion at the height of his pre-crash wealth in September 2008, had been able to liquidate all of his estate, he would have been entitled to one out of every $138 then in circulation. He did not come by this money easily. Vanderbilt was a tough, capable, and stunningly intelligent man, and his life was one of almost constant competition. He fought in almost every arena then available, from fistfights on the New York docks to racing his steamboats up the Hudson, to filing and defending himself in countless lawsuits, to battling for the business of dozens of steamship and rail lines that ran from Connecticut to California, London to Panama, to launching endless coups on Wall Street and in corporate boardrooms, to whipping his prized trotters on against his fellow sportsmen along the upper reaches of what was then the Bloomingdale Road, contests that went on at least two, that on at least two occasions in his old age left him pitched out headfirst on the road in what looked to be fatal accidents. He was a hard man who was hard on those around him, including a wife he seems to have driven to a sanitarium, sons-in-laws who served as his personal minions but who felt the need to constantly prove their worth lest they be thrown over, daughters who snubbed his second wife and bitterly contested his will, a son who suffered a nervous breakdown and put up with all manner of insults from him to win his confidence and his place as his successor, and two more sons who lived tragic lives and never did gain his approval. He was also a man capable of love, of great works of charity in the last years of his life, and even of sentiment, as witnessed by his repeated attempts to contact old friends and loved ones through seances. It is both a great personal and a public story, and T.J. Stiles has done a magnificent job of guiding us through a life crowded with events and with a wonderfully named, a wonderfully colorful supporting cast full of such Dickensian names as James Banker, Henry Clews, George Law, Fernando Wood, Frank Work, Salmon Chase, Daniel Drew, Big Jim Fisk, Jay Gould, Emily Thorne, Amasa Stone, Curtis Peck, Tennessee Claflin, Victoria Woodhull, Erastus Corning, Ponciano Corral, Chauncey Depew, Horace Greeley, A. Oakey Hall, Augustus Shell, John Preen, Azariah Booty, Orondates Moran, am I pronouncing that
right? That's right.
Orondates Moran, and Horace Clark, to name just a few. In short, it's a terrific read. So James Parton once wrote of the young Thomas Jefferson that, along with his command of five foreign languages, he could calculate an eclipse, survey an estate, tie an artery, plan an edifice, try a cause, break a horse, dance a minuet, and play the violin. In the same vein, one could say that Cornelius Vanderbilt could design a steamship, sail it over open ocean and jungle rapids, race a champion horse, run a shipping line, consolidate a railroad, short a stock, raid a corporation, lobby a president, build a rail depot, found a university, and raise an army.
And all before lunchtime.
That's right. just this juxtaposition of skills, I think, says a great deal about what America became in Vanderbilt's time and who ran it. But I think also in view of what's gone on in the country's economy and on Wall Street over the last few months, viewing General Motors' amended plan for its own rescue, for example, in which it actually revised the miles per gallon as future cars are expected to get downward. Anyone seeing that and comparing these executives with their bonuses for going bankrupt, I think is tempted to look at a Vanderbilt or a Morgan or a Carnegie or a Henry Ford and ask, what happened? How did we go from that to this?
Well, I'm going to do what presidential candidates do at debates and first okay. Say thank you for having me here. As Gene mentioned, I was a fellow at the Cullman Center, and it was an incredible experience without which my book wouldn't have been possible. And so thanks very much to the staff, including the manuscripts department, a lot of whom are here, to do such superb work. So just want to make that very important thank you. That difference, that transition, is visible during Vanderbilt's life. And one thing I point out, that Vanderbilt himself was both a pioneer paving the way toward the corporate future, and also in some ways a representative of an older business world. He was sort of the merchant prince of the Medici mold, as I put it. And by creating this huge corporation, the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, it was, I think, in many ways the kind of pioneer of the giant depersonalized corporations we've been talking about. But his primary rival for largest and most important corporation was the Pennsylvania Railroad, one of the four primary railroads in the country after the Civil War, called the trunk lines. And the Pennsylvania Railroad is very interesting because its managers represent very much kind of the modern model of management. And their managers were Andrew Carnegie's mentors, Thomas A. Scott, who was superintendent, then vice president, then president of the railroad, and J. Edgar Thomson. And Vanderbilt was someone who purchased a controlling share of the stock in the corporation, moved into management, and then what he would do is he would not take a salary. He would take only remuneration through dividends on his stocks. And this is, of course, a model we've moved away from. Now we expect stocks, shares to grow in value. There's still some stocks that, of course, that pay dividends, but that's not the primary interest. At that time, it was the primary thing investors looked for, steady return every year in dividends. So Vanderbilt would, he had to make his railroads pay. He had to make it profitable year in, year out for him to get any money out of them. By contrast, the Pennsylvania Railroad, they also paid dividends fairly successfully up to a point.
And this is, by the way, this is how, just to explain, this is how mostly how stocks worked at the time, mm-hmm. that you mostly paid dividends. It wasn't, you weren't, investors weren't so concerned with the stock going up and down, just making sure it paid the...
Exactly. So prices tended to fluctuate, but you didn't see steady and ever-increasing growth. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that would have been fishy to people. They would have thought there was manipulation going on. And so the Pennsylvania Railroad had these professional managers who were not majority shareholders. And what they did is they did things to make money out of the railroad on the side. They were pioneers of the Shell Corporation. Thomas A. Scott was famous in one case for he was so politically influential that he got a bill through the Pennsylvania legislature and got the governor to sign it 34 minutes after it was introduced. So they were very powerful, and they would use their political influence to set up these shell corporations, and they would funnel their railroad's business through these corporations, which they controlled, and in many ways like this, they would funnel money out of the company. And they ran it fairly well up to a point, but when the panic of 1873 hit, their railroad had to stop paying dividends, and the shareholders finally began to look into what they were doing. Vanderbilt's railroads continued to pay dividends throughout the panic. As he put it, he ran his corporations like they were his private personal property. And so how did we get here? You see that origins of that within Vanderbilt's lifetime, that separation of management from ownership, and owners, the shareholders, who aren't really paying attention. And then that creates an incentive for the agents who are running the company to start to engage in stuff on the side and not to be looking over the toward the long-term health of the company. Now, you know, it's an incentive. It doesn't guarantee malfeasance, but you see right. that origin.
Whereas Vanderbilt seems to have always been amazingly hands-on.
I think that's true. And, you know, at the end of his life, much less so. During his, you know, when he was a railroad chief, and he actually testified before a state legislative committee. They said, are you a practical manager? You know, are you somebody who's out setting timetables and, you know, inspecting the locomotives? He said, no, I don't manage anything. And that's not entirely true, because when he thought something was wrong, all of a sudden he was on top of it.
Right.
And people felt his wrath, of which he always had an abundance. But for the most part, when he got to the railroad years, he relinquished operational control. But he always had that eye. Someone was always watching.
And interestingly, always, it seems, able to outcompete other lines, whether on steamships or on railroads, always had that certain genius for seeing how expenses could be cut and customers could be lured away.
It's not a very sexy subject, but that's a consistent trait that you see in successful managers, the most successful of the so-called robber barons. Andrew Carnegie's a great example, Rockefeller. They cut costs. And they were more successful than their rivals at cutting costs. And Vanderbilt once said, if he couldn't run a steamship or a railroad for 20% less than the guy who ran it before him or somebody running alongside him, then he'd just close up business and go out of business.
And in fact, near the end of the book, when you have the start of the Grange and these populist movements from out west who have a huge complaint against the railroad, which is that they're this preferential and often secret pricing system, mm-hmm. where they're moving some people's goods for free. And Vanderbilt's asked for it, and he says, basically, fine. We'd be happy to compete on an equal basis. You know, it's just no problem with them in that.
Yeah, what they're saying is they were complaining about that special legislation that, like Thomas A. Scott would get passed, and others, the railroads would get special laws passed in certain states. And Vanderbilt, so Vanderbilt's response to that complaint was, yeah, sure, great. As long as the laws are the same for everybody, I'm on board.
Yeah.
I can do, as long as the rules are the same, I can beat anyone, is his attitude.
So in that sense, in what was a very rough and tumble business time with few defined business or public ethics, he really, you get the sense he really was something of an honorable man in a sense, or had at least like something of his own sense of honor in how you conducted business.
Yeah, that's a really interesting trait of his, because his business peers had this sort of love-hate is the wrong way to put it, sort of respect-hate. I don't think anyone loved him who was in business with him. But, you know, one of the reasons why the book is longer than it might have been is, you know, I tried to write more than a business story. You know, it's about the making of modern American culture. And, you know, you alluded in your comments to the end of sort of the traces of feudalism or the culture of deference that was held over in the 19th century for a while from the 18th century. And in Vanderbilt's very first years in steamboats, I found these letters from these old gentry families saying, they're undercutting prices, this is scandalous. Have you ever heard of anything so scandalous?
Yes,
they're cutting prices, competition, this is awful.
Yeah.
And the idea of an individualistic competitive economy where it was basically no holds barred was this major cultural shift. And actually, Gordon Wood talks about this in The Radicalism of the American Revolution, that business wasn't just business, it was changing American culture. The idea of individualism and competitiveness was a huge shift, and Vanderbilt was very much in the forefront. But meanwhile, there was a new code of honor that was emerging, and it was sort of like the good sportsmanship, almost, in a way.
Yeah.
And rather than, we're all gentlemen, so let's cut deals with each other, which they did do also, but it's a long story, read the book. But the new code was more about, rather than a gentlemanly code, it was kind of like a fair fight code.
Right.
And he very much stuck to that. And he would say, I found letters here in the library with someone saying, you know, I sent for Vanderbilt and said, we made a deal and I wanted it in writing. He said, no, you know that my word is as good as my bond. And it was very important to him to develop that reputation.
And it's interesting, as you say, because you have all these, what was fair might be putting your ferry boat across the pier so their guy's ferry boat couldn't dock.
Yes.
It might tearing up or burning down the other guy's ferry station might be okay. These really crazy races down, and one thing that's outside the purview of the book, but there's that insane race between the Henry Clay and the other steamship down the Hudson, which lasts all day. Amazingly, you know, wild race. They're just basically throwing people off the boat at their stops and barely pausing to take them on because they're racing each other. And at the end of this, the Henry Clay's boiler explodes and it kills like 150 people or something right up outside of Yonkers. You know, this was basic commuter transportation at the time. As if like rival subway trains were racing each other down the
road. It's very true. And not only that, but it was a spectator sport.
Yeah.
That it really mattered to people that they were on the fastest boat.
I mean, many of them were cheering it on. The ones who weren't panicked and hanging out for dear life were cheering on their steamboat.
Yeah, there were sort of two sets of passengers, the one who were really excited about the racing and the ones who insisted on being towed in a barge behind the boat so that they wouldn't be close to the boiler when it exploded.
Yeah, that was one image in your book. And it just, but that was, all of that was, you know, sort of in a kind of constantly reworked and, you know, sense of honor. That was okay. But then, you know, and all these people end up really respecting the Commodore who were fighting him to the death for steamship lines and rail lines. But then you get down to Jay Gould and Big Jim Fisk, who he seems to have just hated, you know, and who a lot of people seem to have hated. Mm-hmm. And because they stepped over the whole bounds.
Well, that's interesting, too, in the sense that, you know, you go from this early era of... you know, steamboats, for a lot of business reasons, really were very competition-oriented business because steamboats weren't that expensive as big pieces of capital, physical capital. They weren't that expensive. You know, a small group of people could get together and build one. And, you know, you could move it between markets. You know, if you were competing for a while and you either won or lost, you could just take it somewhere else. And one of my favorite examples of that era is that's in the book is in 1838, the Staten Island ferry owner ordered his captain of his ferry to ram a rival ferry and sink it. And I found these court accounts from people who were on that ferry, and it was just unbelievable.
And he almost did. He
almost sank it.
Yeah.
And the passengers on the other ferry, when they got to Staten Island, they ripped down the ferry house and nearly murdered the captain, the president of the. Unbelievable. So then you get to the railroad era. And what's different about railroads? They're fixed pieces of infrastructure. So you could have a price war, but what's going to happen at the end? You have to come to some sort of terms because the other guy is still there. And due to the nature of railroads, because they were so capital intensive and they had such a large workforce, that even if you had no business at all, you're running hardly any trains, your fixed expenses from just maintaining and having the railroad were enormously high, and they didn't go up very much when you started to run more and more trains. So a railroad that was in bad shape would cut prices. Even if they were losing money, it was better than losing even more money from not having the business. So railroads, they're stuck. There's an incentive to undercut prices. And so Vanderbilt takes part in something that had started before his time, which is gentlemen's agreements. He goes, what you had in early America under the culture of deference reappears because of business logic, where you have these cartels. And they had elaborate cartels where they had commissions, and they would hire a commissioner who could fire people from individual railroads who were undercutting prices. And at the same time, curiously, Vanderbilt himself, by the end of his life, is rising in social stature. And so he has he's taken on a business that is sort of inclined toward gentlemanly agreements because of the nature of the business. And he himself is becoming more and more gentlemanly himself. Yeah. He, toward the end of his life, his personality, his demeanor, was much more refined than it was when he was a young steamboat captain. It's kind of a curious parallel in business, personal and business parallel. And then Jay Gould and Jim Fisk come along, brash young upstarts, and they are doing things like telling about secret deals to the press. They are deliberately trying to insult and demean the Commodore. And he became sort of obsessed with them. Even though their railroad, the Erie, was never in much of a position to do him a lot of harm, it became this kind of famous rivalry in the American press between these businessmen.
And they actually start just printing, right, stock certificates. They get a printing press and start printing stock certificates without anything behind them.
Yes.
I mean, just pure larceny.
Yeah.
They somehow avoid, they flee to New Jersey, right, at some point, but they avoid actual jail time over this somehow.
Yeah, it was, there were strict laws that regulated how much you could, how many shares you could issue of a company. And this is something that I don't need to go into up on stage, but it has to do with the whole kind of cultural ferment around the rise of securities. And people really felt that stock, a share of stock represented $100 worth of fixed capital. It was represented something tangible and real. So when you increase the number of shares without building new physical infrastructure, it was widely seen by even the most intellectual figures as fraud. And so when Vanderbilt got in a business fight with Gould and Fisk and Daniel Drew over the Erie Railway, they started, and he was trying to corner the market in their shares, so they just started printing shares like crazy. And it was, you know, very famous episode where Vanderbilt got a judge to issue arrest warrants. Here they are, they're officers of one of the leading, largest corporations in America, scampering onto a ferry and racing away from the police with literally bales of greenbacks in stock. And, you know, they set up shop in what they called Fort Taylor. And
over in New Jersey.
Over in New Jersey, yes. And the Garden State welcomed them and made them a corporation in New Jersey. And so to try to settle the matter, Jay Gould literally went to Albany with a suitcase full of cash. And there are some hilarious figures from the New York State Legislature who they could see both sides of the issue depending on
how much cash was being passed around.
How big the
around.
Suitcase was. And it finally, Vanderbilt actually miraculously managed to force them to pay back a lot of what he had lost. But it's an incredible episode.
And he never kind of never forgave them for it, although he would try to contact Big Jim Fisk in seances, right?
Yes, that was, yeah. What my favorite example of that. About the time of the Civil War is when Vanderbilt starts to go to seances. And as I point out in the book, this is actually the high point of spiritualism in American life. And the Civil War, the better part of 1 million people died. And so people started to go to mediums all the time to contact the dead. And I don't think Vanderbilt definitely did it. I don't think he, though, drew any business base any business decisions on these seances. And not only because he continued to be successful, I personally don't believe in spiritualism, so I don't think the mediums actually were contacting the dead. So I think that they were saying a lot of nonsense when they would conjure up the ghosts. And Vanderbilt clued into that too, even though he still went to seances. So there's a great incident that you're referring to where he called up the ghost of Jim Fisk after Fisk had been shot by the rival for a mistress and shot dead. So Fisk comes up and Vanderbilt asks him a few questions about stock. And of course the answers made no sense at all. Vanderbilt said, "What are you talking about?" You know, he goes, "Okay, all right, we'll see who's right, you or me." And he's arguing with the ghost of Jim Fisk. And then they start to joke with each other. He says, "So how do you like it on the other side?" And Fisk says, "Well, you'll find out soon enough. You're at the end of your line." And so it's a hilarious incident. And it shows, though, I think that he found comfort with seances, but I don't think he based any decisions on them.
Yeah.
But that rivalry, there's a quote that I never found a good source for it, for Vanderbilt saying it, like so many of Vanderbilt's quotes. But it's still one of my favorites because it does summarize his attitude toward Jay Gould. He supposedly said, "It never pays to kick a skunk."
Yeah.
And I never, unfortunately, I wish I could document it. I couldn't document it, so I left it out of the book. I'll just tell you now. Because it was his attitude toward Jay Gould.
Yeah, a good attitude to have.
Yeah. And though in the end, I have to say, he actually, in the most important battles, he either held his own or came off a little better with Jay Gould. But Jay Gould managed to embarrass him, which is one of the reasons why he was so embittered about him. For example, during one rate war, the Erie Railway under Jay Gould and Jim Fisk cut the price of cattle cars from the West, radically undercut them. So of course the New York Central Railroad follows. Then they cut further. Finally, the New York Central Railroad went from, I don't know, $150 a car for cattle to $1 a car. So meanwhile, secretly, Jay Gould and Jim Fisk were buying thousands of heads of cattle out in Chicago, and they're shipping it over the New York Central for almost nothing. And then once they did it, they made a loud announcement to the press.
Yeah.
They couldn't just make a profit, they had to embarrass Vanderbilt. Yeah. So, you know, it's actually in business, it was a trivial dispute. But it was that kind of getting under his skin that just drove him nuts. And by contrast, I mean, this is something we talked about before. With other businessmen, they would have vicious fights, and then they would end up being friends afterwards.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of not personal, Sonny, it's business, you know. And it's funny, too, because that story inadvertently shows the whole span of Vanderbilt's life, in that he's one of the people he's competing against this whole time, is Daniel Drew, this other notorious character, who is supposedly, and probably not true, but started watering stock by, you know, started off his career driving literal stock into New York. That's how you got beef to market in the early 19th century. He drove it down there, and he would supposedly feed it lots of salt and then water it at the collect pond, which is where, you know, the courthouses are now in downtown, this huge pond then. And he would drive the cattle down there. They would drink up water and go on. And that was filled in, became the Five Points. The whole city grew up around here. And by the end of his career, he's fighting these wars over transporting, you know, cattle by the thousands or the millions from halfway across the country. And this is all the, you know, the change that the railroads have brought. But to talk about another skunk for a moment, William Walker, who was what was called a filibuster, nothing to do with the senatorial maneuver, but at the time referred to kind of a freebooter, somebody who would go down and try to take over a country. And it was quite a rash of these in the 1840s and 50s, Americans who decided to go down with often a handful of mercenaries and maybe start fighting in a civil war in a Latin American country and then try to take it over. And this was considered a great thing by kind of Southern and Confederate-leaning individuals who thought that this would be a natural field to expand slavery in.
Well, especially in the case of Cuba, which was, after the fall of the Spanish Empire in Latin America, of course, Cuba remained the star, the jewel of the Spanish overseas possessions. And there was large-scale slavery there already, and there were a lot of Cubans who were fighting very hard for independence as well. And there was also a large Cuban population in New York, which my classmate Alessandro Perez is writing about. And Cuba especially, the Southerners who were looking to expand slavery were fascinated with. But Walker, who was ended up landing in San Francisco, he invaded Mexico unsuccessfully, with a handful of men. And then he got a contract to fight for one side in the Nicaraguan Civil War. So he sailed off with 56 men to fight for one side in Nicaragua's almost perpetual civil war. And Nicaragua was a country where two times in Vanderbilt's career life, he made radical changes in his career. And the California Gold Rush was the first of these, where he'd been involved in steamboat lines radiating out of New York through the Northeast. And then when the Gold Rush started, he abruptly got out of that and went into transatlantic and California-bound steamships. And the main route of commerce and for much of the migration was by steamship down to Panama, crossing at Panama, up to another steamship on the Pacific. And Vanderbilt started a rival line across Nicaragua, tried to build a canal, couldn't get funding. And they would carry people across the waterways of Nicaragua by boat and short land crossing. Very successful. He sold out, went on a grand tour of Europe, engaged in various other affairs. Then he started to buy control of this company, the Accessory Transit Company, once again. At the very moment when he was doing that, Walker sailed off to Nicaragua by luck. He was a terrible general.
You have a great description. His generalship usually consisted of just ordering frontal attacks against completely well dug in positions.
Yeah, and which reflected, you know, the filibuster attitude, the North American attitude toward Latin America was, you know, we're Americans, so we're one of us is worth 10 of them. So even though he's dug in, you know, behind fortified walls and he has a rifle, well, you know, don't worry, you're Americans, go get them, go. and fortunately, once he, by luck, really, he carries out one maneuver, by luck, he manages to win. By luck, the leading general and the head of state for his side die, and he ends up being the strongman. Can't even speak Spanish. And he's the strongman in Nicaragua. And thousands of Americans, you know, who are excited by the success, start coming down or want to come down to join him. And meanwhile, this is a story which completely overturns the whole presumptions about how this story played out, with papers I found here in legal papers that a lawyer has in the here in the manuscripts department. Most people said, well, you know, Vanderbilt's rivals within the company knew he was taking control, so they convinced Walker, give us control of the rights for carrying passengers, and then we'll bring free reinforcements, and then Vanderbilt realized he was betrayed. In fact, a friend of Walker's went to the San Francisco agent of the company, Cornelius Garrison, who one of the guys who ends up betraying Vanderbilt, and says, look, you know, your company is going to be destroyed. He said, well, how do you know? Well, Walker's my friend. I'm going to tell him to destroy it. And I think, you know, he's going to give the rights to me, I think. And I don't have any ships. You do. I'll sell the rights to you. And there was this hilarious exchange where Garrison said, well, you know, I couldn't do anything against the company. But, you know, if they fall, I really don't want to fall with them, so okay. And this whole story plays out with these political, corrupt political figures, these self-interested characters who are woven through, you know, the 1850s especially. It was like a part of American culture. It was political corruption, and Walker carried it off to Nicaragua. And so anyway, so Walker does this, gives the rights to Vanderbilt's enemies, who become his enemies. And Vanderbilt tries to get the, you know, they destroy this company as Vanderbilt buys control of it again. And Vanderbilt unsuccessfully tried to get the U.S. government and the British to intervene. They don't want to help for various reasons.
And Walker's doing all these things, like he brings back slavery in Nicaragua.
Yeah,
just a horrible...
Unbelievable. And he had no interest in annexing Nicaragua to the U.S. He had these Napoleonic visions that he would conquer all of Latin America. So needless to say, the neighbors of Nicaragua got a little worried about him. And so Vanderbilt carried out this private foreign policy. He started negotiating with the neighbors, sent off. He found this this guy who had been acquitted of murdering his captain when he was a first mate, was acquitted because no one saw him do it. He went into the captain's cabin, came out. The captain had been bludgeoned to death, but no one saw him do it. So, and he had worked in Nicaragua, so Vanderbilt sent him off to Costa Rica with a crate of gold and a bunch of rifles. And he led a commando raid that, some wonderful scenes, that seized all these steamboats and cut off Walker from his reinforcements. And it really is, it's something out of a Conrad novel. It's just remarkable.
Or Marquez. And is this one American, Scott, I think, who's down there.
Captain Scott.
Captain Scott. And Vanderbilt owes him money from something. So because of this, he's obstructing everything Vanderbilt's doing or refusing to hand over these ships. He's just kind of holding out. And finally, Vanderbilt pays him back. So
the entire war, the thousands of people would have lived if Vanderbilt sent down a guy initially who said, tell Scott that I own the company, you know, take control of the steamboats. The British had a fleet there. They would have protected the steamboats from Walker. And it would have just cut everything off almost at the beginning. And this local guy who Vanderbilt had hired when he was 17 years old and the very first steamboat Vanderbilt captain, the local guy says, hell no, I'm owed $17,000 by the company. Until I'm paid, I'm not cooperating. So as a result, this entire international war involving five countries plays out. And then later, when Vanderbilt's, you know, they win the war and Vanderbilt sends down a guy again to try to take control of the steamboats, and he chases him off the boats with a revolver saying, you know, I'm going to shoot you unless you pay me. And this one little unknown character, because of his personal debt that hasn't been paid, ends up changing the history of about four or five countries.
He almost seems Vanderbilt like himself.
Yeah, but Vanderbilt hires him in the end.
I mean, it really would have been probably most logical for the canal to go through Nicaragua too, from in terms of the waterways available there. But
it seems that way. I mean, I don't know the later history of what happened. I do know that one of the consequences of this entire episode, in which William Walker, this North American, takes over Nicaragua, reinstitutes slavery, is that what Vanderbilt found when he tried to get the business going again. Okay, so he won the war. The Nicaraguans, they would walk up to the line of allowing him to once again carry passengers across Nicaragua, and then they said, you know what, we just can't accept the idea of North Americans coming in large numbers again. You know, we almost lost our nationality. We just can't do it.
Well,
so,
and one of Walker's things is, in the midst of this whole war, he ends up burning down most of the capital, right? Some kind of horrible defense of it. He just really ruined the country.
Yeah, and, absolutely. He really was devastating. Just truly an international criminal. I mean, he was a Dr. Evil of his day, only a real one.
And one of these foreign incidents we've completely blanked from our past. It doesn't exist in America anymore. It was made into a very bad, weird Ed Harris Marley Matin movie some years ago. But
a movie with a message that had helicopters coming in the
1850s. Right, and cars. It's a very strange movie. Another part of Vanderbilt at war, the whole thing for in which he went out to kind of fight with the Merrimack, or sent a ship out to fight with the Merrimack, which is the first ironclad which the Confederacy had built, which really threatened the entire Civil War plan of the Union, which is to basically blockade the South. And all of a sudden, the South has built this ironclad ship that can sink, you know, it's terrifying, comes out and sinks two American warships immediately. It looks invulnerable, cannon shells burst off it, bounce off it. And so Vanderbilt has come up with his own ship to combat this.
Yeah, and again, this goes to the kind of complex nature of Vanderbilt because you know, he was somebody who firmly, I'm sure he never read Adam Smith, but he firmly believed in the invisible hand. And he believed that, you know, we make progress as a society by everybody pursuing their own interests as fiercely as possible. And he firmly believed that, you know, it's almost my duty as a citizen, you pursue your interests and you fight for them. And he thought that's what everybody should do. But one of the exceptions to that is he was deeply patriotic. And he had three sons, and he named them, as I put it, after his heroes, George Washington, William Henry Harrison, and Cornelius Vanderbilt. So and so when the Civil War came around, he tried to give his largest steamship, which had cost him nearly $1 million, he tried to give it to the Union Navy. And Gideon Welles said no. The Secretary of the Navy, he was a little prickly. Nobody thought the war would last that long. He thought we're going to have this expensive ship, it's going to be a you know, white elephant for the Navy. He said no. And so Vanderbilt ended up being forced, actually, against his will, to lease it for very large sums to the War Department. Complicated story of that we'll have the free market people all shaking their heads. Because it really was a crazy result. But then the Merrimack, as you put it, comes steaming out of Norfolk Harbor, sinks all these Union ships. And of course, we all know the Monitor came down, the Union ironclad battles it to a standstill, and the standard version is end of story. But at that point, there was only one ship that could handle the Merrimack, and if the Monitor had had a simple mechanical breakdown, they would have been helpless.
Which it often did, yeah.
Yeah. So, so Secretary of War Stanton telegraphed Vanderbilt and said, can you help? And so he rushed to Washington. He met with Lincoln himself. And Lincoln said, you know, what can you do? And he said, I will outfit my largest steamship, and I'll bring it down so that, he said, probably what will happen is they won't risk the Merrimack against it. It'll bottle it up in port. And that's actually what ended up happening. But so Lincoln said, well, how much are you going to charge? He said, free. I'm giving it to you. Yeah. And so he, within a few days, he'd outfitted it with a ram. He did various things to protect it from shot and shell and brought it down personally with extraordinary authority from Lincoln to personally decide how it should be officered and deployed. Yeah. And when he met with the Union personnel, naval personnel, he said, you know what you're doing, you can take it. And that's how it worked. It basically bottled up the Merrimack. They never did risk it against the Vanderbilt.
It was much faster than the Merrimack and had this ram, and so it could have maneuvered and possibly rammed it before it could sink it.
Or simply just run it down and sunk it. And then he re-equipped it as a cruiser to go after the Confederate commerce raider Alabama.
Yeah.
And in my chapter on the Civil War, there's this whole kind of long-distance duel between Captain Semmes of the Alabama, who wants to get revenge against Vanderbilt for giving this expensive ship to the Union Navy, and he goes after the gold shipments coming from California. And there's a great little story that played out as a result of that.
A hard man to live with, it seems. A hard man on his family. Constantly, the family, you kind of hint that he took out a lot of his, possibly took out a lot of his business anxieties at all at home. Mm. And was particularly hard on his sons, mm-hmm. wanting them to live up to some, you know, the standard he himself set. Mm-hmm. So the oldest, William, has a breakdown after working for a short time on Wall Street.
For Daniel Drew.
And for Daniel Drew, and goes and starts a farm on Staten Island. Mm. That's very successful. And he eventually comes back and inherits most of the fortune and the business. But the other two, Cornille is an epileptic and has a huge gambling problem, mm-hmm. and is kind of a ne'er-do-well his whole life. And then George Washington Vanderbilt is almost mysterious, mm-hmm. who signs up for the, he goes to West Point, mm-hmm. and then is, you know, in the Union Army, but goes AWOL, or?
Yeah, he actually, something that I found in the National Archives with the help of the staff there, that youngest son, George Washington Vanderbilt, was, by all accounts, Vanderbilt's pride and joy, because of the three sons, he was the only one who, like Vanderbilt himself, was athletic. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Vanderbilt was someone of just immense personal capabilities.
Six feet tall, 200 pounds.
That's right.
Straight as an Indian, was the description of him.
Yeah, standing straight and tall as an Indian, as his longtime clerk put it. This is a guy who got involved in and won fist fights into his 50s. Yeah. You know, he was not... he was not just good in business. He was also a good card player. He was an excellent horse racer. He was somebody who was just always out to compete and win under all circumstances. And here his sons were, you know, one is, as you put it, a Cornille is a gambling addict and epileptic. William...
may have been gay.
It's possible, yeah. It's possible he was gay. Yeah. And his son William was very good in business, but he was, you know, kind of pudgy and unathletic and kind of a sad sack personally in his demeanor. And so here was George Washington Vanderbilt, you know, tall, athletic, and started the Civil War. He went AWOL. He was court-martialed and convicted, which didn't end a career back then. Returned to duty, was never assigned to combat duty, I found. Ended up getting sick and died during the Civil War of consumption. You know, he didn't even die in the battlefield. Vanderbilt was just very broken up about it, and I think contributed to his interest in spiritualism.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about Cornille is that he takes up a lot of space in the book, not only because he was an important part of Vanderbilt's life, and not only because there's a lot of material about him, but because he was everything his father wasn't. You know, he was physically afflicted. He was morally weak the way Vanderbilt saw it. They didn't have the language for addiction then that we do now. And he was a real addict. And so he was boastful. He was a cheat. He was stealing money. You know, he ended up, Horace Greeley, for some reason, became his special patron and friend. And Horace Greeley died with Kernil owing him tens of thousands of dollars. And, you know, it was just a source of great shame and anger for Vanderbilt. And yet he also never cut him off completely. And his first wife said his attitude toward Kernil was stubborn inconsistency. And so this relationship, it's important in and of itself, but it was one of the ways in which I got access to the moral or the emotional complexity of Vanderbilt, a man who, because of these great personal capabilities, comes across as, you know, just this kind of two-dimensional figure, the statue that's in front of Grand Central.
Yes.
Whereas in Kernil, you know, these conflicting feelings really brings out that very human side and very understandably complicated side of him.
Yeah, and the whole tortured relationship with the first wife who he put in an asylum for a while and then took her out and seems to have had a lot of ups and downs, mostly around Vanderbilt's probable, you know, yen for various mistresses.
Possibly, such, but yeah, very hard to know.
Talking about the statue for a moment, the physical city that Vanderbilt shaped. You know, he was this land speculator along with everybody else, it seems, in New York at the time, loaned money here and there, and built these depots. And it's amazing to me, like, the kind of the rise and the fall at the time. You know, you have St. John's Park, which was, which Gramercy Park is modeled after, to get an idea of what it looked like. And it was, in the space of like 40 years, it went from being just a plot of land owned by Trinity Church to being the most fashionable neighborhood in the city, to being something of a rundown, kind of abandoned neighborhood, to being a rail depot that Vanderbilt built there, to being the entrance to the tunnel, to the, which is, I was
Holland Tunnel.
The Holland Tunnel, you know, right there. You know, nobody knows this place existed anymore in New York. You know, it's just forgotten out of modern memory. It's like,
I mean,
one
can you imagine
sign down there.
Somebody taking Gramercy Park and ripping it down and having a tunnel exit there.
And to the point
that,
like,
all this open space,
and
we could make use of it.
Yeah, 150 years ago, 150 years later, nobody would have ever heard of Gramercy Park.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing how fast New York was changing. And that's where they built a freight depot and they put the original statue of the Commodore up. With the frieze, which I guess has been lost, or?
Yeah, I think it's been, I don't know, I haven't been able to track it down. I mean, maybe people know what happened to it, but, you know, this frieze that was on either side, you know, it was very much like, you know, a gated park in Lower Manhattan, very much like Gramercy Park, and they ripped it down, put up this huge freight depot, and at the top was a statue of Vanderbilt, and this huge bronze frieze on either side that depicted his career, you know, sailboats and steamships and railroads and whatnot. And that part of it, the statue was moved to the front of Grand Central Terminal. And the frieze, I don't know what happened to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting because I keep saying it's interesting. Obviously, I think it's interesting. I wrote this damn book. But I know an archivist at Wells Fargo. And so I said, I don't know if you like the book because William Fargo is kind of an enemy in the book. He said, well, you know, I said, Wells Fargo is still around. New York Central Railroad isn't. So, and I said, oh, good point. Except this physical, in addition to his legacy in creating the corporate world and developing this kind of financial and economic kind of, as I put it, the unseen architecture of our world, he also, you know, built this infrastructure. He built the original Grand Central. He built the what is now the tunnel that runs up Park Avenue, constructed a lot of the rail infrastructure that to this day is a vital part of the city. And his a good reason for having a statue out in front of the modern Grand Central.
Metaphorically, it's almost the last stand. I mean, the traffic, there's the Commodore standing and the traffic kind of breaks around him.
Yeah, that's right.
The cars which have overwhelmed his society and his means of transportation still haven't been succeeded in tearing down Grand Central, although they came close.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's amazing the way this would all run. I mean, the depot was there because there was a law in the city against having steam-powered rail below 42nd Street, because most of the city was below there, and it would be a catastrophe for people being run over by it. And then on top of this, you had the trains coming down through this trench. And I love the description that, like, that early on, when the trains would come into the original Grand Central, they would actually decouple the engine from the rest of the train at a precise moment to keep the too much steam from coming into the right, too much smoke from coming into the train shed. So this is how you'd actually come into New York, that your engine would slide off onto a railing, and your unpowered train would glide in.
Yeah.
You know, just the to think about the how you must have been able to judge that. What a skill that must have been to not send the whole thing.
Presumably, they
into the,
slowed down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there were braking mechanisms on the cars, but but still, like, what an amazing.
Yeah, it's you know this. We have to think about how New York at this time was a low-rise city. Yeah, you know, they as Dickens described it in the 1840s, which applied through the 1860s and 70s, it was a jumbled herd of buildings with here and there a steeple sticking up.
Yeah.
And that was New York. And so the original Grand Central was this just massive building. It was the largest, second largest railroad depot in the world and largest in the Western Hemisphere. Just gigantic building with this enormous glass shed roof with, I think it was 14 tracks. I mean, the when they constructed Grand Central, and much of it was paid for by Vanderbilt personally, you know, came right out of his, he bought the stock that was issued for it personally. And, you know, this enormous piece of infrastructure, even though that building isn't there today, it was a major contribution to the whole development of Midtown and spread of this area. And yes, it was there because of certain laws, but it was his financial capacities and the planning of his son that really brought it into being.
And the amazing difficulty of putting in modern kind of industrial-powered transportation and infrastructure into this hugely crowded city, which New York has always been fairly ingenious about, and this is a really
he tried to build an underground rail system all the way down to City Hall and decided it just wouldn't pay in the end.
Well, yeah, looked into a subway, right, at some point.
Actually chartered a corporation to do it and in the end decided it wouldn't pay, so...
Yeah, we decided that to this day too. unless we charge everybody $250. how was it in terms of?
We're beginning to run short on time.
Okay, so just in terms of writing the book, how was it being with the, you know, you always hear biographers say they do or don't do somebody because they don't want to spend that time with them or don't. How was it being with the Commodore for that?
Note to go out on. Brenda Maddox, who's a great biographer. I think she once wrote an article called "What's Love Got to Do with It?"
Yeah,
and I think there's a good point to that. You know, if somebody's interesting, and the things that surround their life are interesting, then you know it's okay if you know he's an SOB some of the time.
Yeah,
it's okay. I mean, the secret for me is: are there big questions? Is there drama that surrounds their life so that the story is interesting? Are there big questions so that it speaks to something that interests me intellectually? And then finally, they don't have to be nice, but they have to be human. And much of the struggle for me as a writer was, as I put it with Corneille, pulling out that emotional complexity so that, you know, we may not, you know, want to spend an hour in a railroad car with him, but, you know, we can really understand where he was coming from and his full complexity as a human being comes out. So when I started to get into that, it was really fascinating for me on the big and on the little level. And then, you know, it was okay with me if he was sometimes a very hard man because he was a human being, and that made it something that I could connect with.
And the complexity certainly comes across in this outstanding book. So thanks very much for writing it.
Thanks for coming.
I guess if we have questions or, yeah.
Oh, no, we actually, do we have a microphone for questions? Okay.
Ah, okay, great. And remember, no thronging, you know.
Yes.
First question?
Anybody?
One of the quotes attributed to Vanderbilt that may in fact be apocryphal, I think comes from the William Walker era, but it may not, and it may not be true, is he was furious at people and he said, "Gentlemen, you have wronged me. I would sue you, but the law takes too long. Instead, I will ruin you."
Yes, that is considered the most famous letter probably in American business history. "Gentlemen, you've undertaken to cheat me. I won't sue you. The law is too slow. I'll ruin you. Yours truly, Cornelius Vanderbilt." However, the first time that appeared that I could find, and I spent a little time looking, was in his obituary in the New York Times in 1877. And I think that a not too careful writer took probably something he had heard that actually echoes testimony he gave in 1867 in a completely, 20 years later, an unrelated issue when he had shut off all train traffic into New York City, another story. And he said, you know, the law to my mind is too slow when I have the power in my own hands to punish. He said, you know, then I'll take things into my own hands when I can. Now that was a specific incident that was years later, and I think it got translated into this letter, which I don't think he ever wrote. What happened is that he had gone off on this grand tour of Europe in 1853 in a private yacht that was the size of a transatlantic steamship. It became a liner afterwards. And while he was away, his partners in the accessory transit company betrayed him and kicked him out of the company, held back money that was owed to him. And so when he came back, he was outraged and set the stage for a big business battle. But what he did is he wrote a letter to the press saying, I'm going to sue. What he really did was exactly the opposite. He said, if we can't settle this, then the courts will decide. And of course, in the end, the courts did not decide. He started a rival line and competed until they paid him off, essentially.
So he was essentially American. He was going to sue first.
He was going to sue first, yes. As a matter of fact, you know, this is something that was very interesting in researching this book, that court records were absolutely critical. And I stumbled into the old records division of the New York County Clerk's Office. Of course, I mentioned court records that are here in a lawyer's papers. And I just had never seen the New York County Clerk's Office cited in histories of this period. And they just completed a computerized index of all the surviving court papers. And their papers there are going back to the 1600s. And they would bring out, you know, I'd be next to people getting certified copies of old divorce decrees. And I was almost the only historian working there. And they would bring out these bundled papers wrapped in red tape. And I would have to be careful not to break them when I unfolded them. And it would have all of this testimony about secret deals that today would be illegal and that then they asked a court to enforce. Inside trading.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't suing because someone was inside trading. It was because they didn't divide the profits properly. And so his lawsuits, he sued again and again, and he was sued again and again. And often it was just a matter of leverage in business negotiations. But he was never afraid of the courts. If he could deal without the courts, he preferred that. But to the end of his life, he was in court all the time.
It's interesting when we talk about our litigious society today, you know.
Litigious society, exactly.
It doesn't seem to have started today.
No, I mean, the first lawsuit that he filed was in 1816 when he was 22 years old, at least the lawsuit for which the paper survived. And so, the litigious society goes all the way back to the beginning. Do we have another question?
Yes, yeah.
Two questions. First, do you watch Gossip Girl?
No.
Did you know there's a descendant supposedly on the show of the Vanderbilts on Gossip Girl? And last week, one of them said that they had season tickets to the Mets games. And I was thought, that's what it comes to. You got to be a Vanderbilt to have season
tickets. Yeah, you have season tickets the Yankees, to. Yes.
Second question.
Well, give me a chance to answer that one first. No, please go ahead.
Do you, in your estimation, did any of the later figures, the ones that we now know as robber barons, did they approach Vanderbilt's achievement? Let's say Andrew Carnegie, I think, was probably the greatest of the group. I was wondering what you thought about the ones that followed, the next generation.
Well, this is a difficult question because, you know, if you're a biographer, you know, you're sort of automatically convinced that you're writing about the most important person who's ever lived. So maybe my answer isn't fair. I also think it's so subjective because they even though they overlapped, and Vanderbilt dealt personally with Rockefeller, and he overlapped with Carnegie also, who wanted to sell steel rails to Vanderbilt's railroad empire. One difference about Vanderbilt with these other figures who are incredibly important, and I think a very good case could be made that they're at least as important as Vanderbilt. But Vanderbilt covered a longer period and a more formative period. So the kind of corporate world and financial markets that Rockefeller and Carnegie and a lot of these later figures dealt with, Vanderbilt helped create. The United States as a continent-spanning country, Vanderbilt played a role in simply the geographical expansion of the U.S. In, as I said, the making of you know, our economic values, Vanderbilt was at the heart of that. Even as a young man printing advertising that picked up Jacksonian rhetoric very explicitly. So I don't want in any way to diminish the importance of people like Rockefeller and Carnegie, or later on Ford, or many of these others. I mean, what they did is incredibly important in developing the economy and also in creating a lot of practices. J.P. Morgan, of course, in a very different way. You know, Gene Strauss has written brilliantly about his importance. And as a banker, he intersected and dealt with so many other areas of industrial America, railroads and other areas. So I don't want to diminish their importance. And to a certain extent, it's kind of meaningless to say, well, you know, who's up and who's down. But the distinction, as I said, I would make is that Vanderbilt covered this very formative period. Born in the presidency of George Washington, starting in business as a teenager before the War of 1812, when there were a few million Americans living along a coastal strip in the Atlantic, and ending his days after making deals with John D. Rockefeller personally. So it's very hard to match a career of that length and of that and over such a formative period as well. So, you know, the case that I make sort of humbly, because these other guys are so important, is that's much of the key to his particular significance.
The most comparable figure seems to me in terms of the hands-on building of something is Ford, you know, who was somebody who built, you know, who built the first cars he had, you know, came, you know, adapted the assembly line to them, actually raced these cars as an advertisement for them, worked out the whole plan to pay his workers enough to, you know, to create a market for his product. And even Ford didn't switch suddenly like midlife and go into building airplanes or something, you know, which is essentially what, he built tractors and things too. So, but, well, that's true. But that was by the time he's kind of quasi senile and they kind of take the plant away from him and everything. But he's, but it is, you know, I mean, Vanderbilt's amazing, like the hands-on part of it, I think is very, is almost unique.
And these giant leaps he made. I mean, one of the things about the book is it's almost a history of the American economy, just because he had such an unerring sense for the kind of primary channel of commerce, and he would seize upon it and become the most successful competitor. So, you know, when Philadelphia and New York were the two main financial centers, that's where his transportation line ran. And then the Erie Canal opened, and he's operating on the Hudson. And then industrialization started with the textile mills in New England. So he enters the trade, the steamboat and railroad lines with New England and New York. Then the gold rush, and he gets into that traffic. And just one step after another, he had an unerring sense for where the sort of vital center of commerce was, and goes directly to that and manages to find a route and a transportation system that had a decisive strategic advantage over his competitors, and then, you know, made it pay in a way that nobody else could. Yeah. Oh, microphone's coming, so.
Are there personal threats on him in terms of his own life of security, or he had so many enemies? Or?
That's an interesting question, because there's a book, The Day Wall Street Exploded. I mean, we've seen a lot of attention given to the fact that you know, these titans have been threatened and attacked in the past. In Vanderbilt's case, not that I know of. As a matter of fact, Vanderbilt was famous even late in life, when he was in his 70s and 80s, and whether he really did this is an open question, but he had a reputation for accepting all callers at his private office on West 4th Street in the Washington Square District. He would race as Kevin Baker mentioned earlier, he would race his fast trotters personally through the rural roads of Upper Manhattan and engage in pickup races. And as I said, into the 1850s or 1840s, you know, the man was in his 50s, and he occasionally got into fistfights. And he had this reputation, but I found court records. you know, where the guy is suing, and Vanderbilt's lawyer says, you know, Vanderbilt gently laid his hands upon him to remove him, and, you know, guy ends up somehow unconscious, yeah, locked in the pilot house.
He was kind of, I like the idea of him kind of drag racing in upper Manhattan.
Yeah, so he was a guy who always felt he could take care of himself, yeah. And I don't think he ever came in for personal threats, at least none that he couldn't handle.
But you know, it's interesting, too, and he dies just before the kind of class war in the U.S. really heats up. Like later in the year, he dies. There's a huge nationwide rail strike.
Yeah, that gets 1877.
That gets very ugly, and it's just, you know, I guess he would have probably been in the thick of that if he had lived. But
yeah, and that, I mean, that is a something that I try to bring out in my book. That I mean, one reason why I'm glad that you know, you're the doing this event is that, you know, your novels bring out that the multi-layered society in New York.
Thanks.
And so well, and that's something that I, of course, since I'm focusing on a wealthy individual, I could only touch upon, but I tried to, you know, talk about the fact that this is a society which is growing more polarized, in which you have, with the rise of large enterprises, you have the rise of the labor movement and of, you know, mass armies of people working for wages, something that was new in America. And so the social complexity of America develops through his life, and so Vanderbilt, it would have been very interesting to see what would have happened if he'd remained alive and in control for a year or two more, because 1877 was a violent nationwide labor conflict.
Yeah.
Really interesting and troubling episode.
And then he goes from this guy who can't spell, really, to having his daughter. Is it his daughter who starts the Society 400 with the big ball? Is that, I mean granddaughter.
Yeah, the grand.
Alma.
It was his granddaughter. And I think it's interesting that William Vanderbilt, you know, Vanderbilt had what was considered a substantial mansion, but late in life, it's very much like Edith Wharton's novel, Custom of the Country, where Vanderbilt was sort of the Washington Square old, even though the people in that novel would have shunned him probably for much of his life. You know, he had a substantial brownstone, but nothing fancier than that. But as soon as he died, and as soon as the will trial was settled, his son and his grandchildren start putting up the huge Gilded Age palaces. And I think it's very interesting that they waited till the old man was gone before they started spending lavishly and having these grand balls. I think he would have thought it was a lot of nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, he could spend $18,000 on a racehorse, but you know, building a fancy palace would have just been extravagance beyond his respect. You can ask afterwards.
With all of his accomplishments, did he never think of science, medicine? Was that sort of gone?
That's a good question. You know, as a little side note, he, you know, through much of his life, what we would think of as kind of modern science and technical education and development didn't exist. And he was a self-educated engineer, essentially. He was probably one of the leading maritime architects of the paddle wheel era. He personally designed his steamboats and steamships, often going against conventional wisdom. So he was technically himself quite accomplished when it came to naval engineering. But when it comes to charity, he was a man who was not known for charity. His friends claimed that he hated boasting, he hated braggarts, so they claimed that he engaged in private charity. Of course, who knows whether he really did. But at the end of his life, he did make a point of endowing Vanderbilt University in Nashville. However, I think there's good reason to think that, yes, he wanted to create an institution of learning because he did feel throughout his life the fact that he was uneducated. And every chance he had to speak, and this was a great era of oratory where, you know, you couldn't have tea without somebody getting up and giving a two-hour speech. He refused to speak. He'd always have someone else speak for him. So I think that he did feel his lack of education. But also, part of his project with Vanderbilt University reflected part of his patriotism. Having given $1 million steamship to the Union Navy, he made it very much a personal project to try to reach out to the South after the Civil War. Now, of course, he was thinking of the White South.
Yeah.
His second wife was an unrepentant Confederate. He thought that was great. He had General Braxton Bragg, who would denounce the abolition tyrant in his wartime orders, as a witness at his second wedding. So when he reached out to the South, we're talking the White South. But it did reflect a sincere, taking him on his own terms, a sincere patriotism that he wanted to kind of show that Northern men who fought for the Union wanted to restore the Union afterwards. So that's why he very much wanted to endow a university in the South.
What would Vanderbilt say to Obama right now about what's going on with our financial system, with our economy? What would his advice be?
Well, he'd wonder, first of all, how a black man became president. I think that would astound him. You know, that's a difficult question. And I think we're probably, should we make this a last question? So this is the sort of question that historians hate because, you know, frankly, any one of you could get up and make a pronouncement on this and it would probably be as accurate as anything I could say. It's utterly unprovable. What I would say is this, that there's kind of two counterbalancing sides to him. One, he believed in laissez-faire, which had been a kind of radical philosophy in his youth, but also neatly suited him when he was a corporate chieftain in the end. He did not believe in the government getting involved in the economy. As he once put it, when they were trying to pass a law in New York State to regulate the railroads, he saw it in terms of private interests being the key to a well-functioning economy. And he said, well, if you can pass a law that makes men serve their interests more effectively than their interests themselves will compel them, that's fine, but I don't think you can. He thought society works by everybody pursuing their own interests. On the other hand, you know, he grasped the economy, which after the Civil War, the federal government had taken on unprecedented new involvement in the economy. And when the panic of 1873 hit, he stepped in and he said the Treasury should be increasing liquidity in the markets by issuing greenbacks. And he was calling for a limited but a clear type of federal intervention in the economy, very much limited compared to what we're doing now. So, no, I can't tell you what he would say to President Obama, but I can say that at the very least he would have had a sophisticated view and a pragmatic view. So he did have these clear laissez-faire Jacksonian beliefs. On the other hand, you know, he took the world as it was, and he saw what he needed, what was needed to be done to make it work under the rules that existed, and so he probably would have a, you know, at the very least a sophisticated but pragmatic view of what's going on now.
I think he'd be a little astonished by businessmen who expected the government to bail them out and who then
yes.
still expected to have a major say in how they would run things. I think he'd be
absolutely.
He'd be amazed at that, the idea that you could, you know, rely on somebody else for the money and still expect to be in charge, that would kind of
yep.
go against them philosophically.
You make your bets and you live by the results. That
yeah.
was his belief, certainly.
Yeah.
And when he lost, he did everything he could to get back what he thought was his. But, you know, as he said, you pick your friends and you have to suffer the consequences. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure.